Hello and welcome to today's program at the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our speaker tonight is Adam Leipzig, speaking on Hollywood creativity and innovation. I want to tell you a little bit about Adam and then we're going to go into our program. So from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Dead Poets Society to March of the Penguins, from co-founding the Los Angeles Theater Center and producing 300 shows there, to publishing Cultural Weekly, a fast-growing online magazine, Adam Leipzig has emerged as a thought leader fusing creative process with business results. Adam is a former senior vice president of Walt Disney Studios and most recently was the president of National Geographic Films. Today, he's advising companies, training creative people about business, and mentoring business people about creative connections, all of which give him a unique perspective on how he can achieve, how we can achieve our potential as individuals, in our companies, and in our country. Please welcome Adam Leipzig to the Commonwealth Club this evening.
Thank you. I hate to begin by contradicting. Please turn them on. Please make sure they're silenced, but please turn them on. I invite you to share, blog, post, tweet, Facebook. Let everybody know whatever might be interesting for you tonight. We live in a world where we are always wanting to share what we're talking about. Thank you. It's an illusion, so it's got to work, he said. It's a trick. It's got to shake them out of their seats. It's got to transform them. He was Robert Altman. And we are in a theater, a small theater in Los Angeles, 187 seats. And the trick, the illusion, the thing that had to transform the audience that he was talking about was this effect at the end of the play, where the main character walks up a staircase, puts a noose around his neck, jumps off, and the body falls. Now, of course, it would be very expensive to do that with a real actor every night. So we had to make a dummy, a model of the actor. And I was producing this play. And, you know, if you're producing a play for Robert Altman, now this was when Robert Altman had first decided he wanted to direct in theater. This is Bob Altman, who directed McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Three Women and Gosford Park and The Player and Shortcuts. You want to do a good job. So we worked all night on this dummy of the actor. And we brought it up the stairs and we put it down on the lobby floor, and we called Bob out of rehearsal, and Bob was kind of a big bear of a guy with a grizzly gray beard, and kind of, imagine a halo, maybe backlit through the marijuana haze coming over him, and he looks it up, and he looks it down, and he says, "That's adequate." And he goes back into rehearsal. Okay, now, you're freaking out, right? Because this is Bob Altman. And adequate is not going to cut it. So you bring it downstairs, and you work on it overnight, and the next day you lug it back up the stairs, and you lay it down on the lobby floor, and you call Bob out of rehearsal at a break. He slowly saunters out, and he looks it up, and he looks it down. And he says, "It's adequate." And he goes back into rehearsal. Okay, so now you're totally freaking out. Because you cannot have adequate for Bob Altman. And you go down and you look at it and you realize, well, you know, the boots could be a little bit different and it could be weighted a little bit better and the clothes could be aged down just a little bit more to match the costume that the actor is wearing. And you bring it upstairs and you very gently, lovingly lay it down and you say a little prayer and you call Bob out of rehearsal again. And he looks it up and he looks it down and he says, "That's adequate, and you can stop working on it now." And he goes back into rehearsal. And the thing that we realized later, from talking to other people who had worked with Bob, is that the highest praise he ever gave was, "That's adequate." Because he knew if he kept saying, "It's only adequate," that people would push themselves and push themselves and push themselves to go for excellence. Well, perhaps you share my frustration that the work that you do, that the work that we receive, the best creative and entrepreneurial work, is only usually adequate. And the work that is the greatest work that we have, that we hold within ourselves in this soft, squishy, sacred place inside ourselves that we want to share with the world, it seems as though the world doesn't want. And the best that the world wants is just the adequate part of ourselves. And we know that the world deserves better, and we know that we have more to express of ourselves. And we are tired and frustrated at the adequatization of our lives. And the adequatization of the world, of the creative work, of the entrepreneurial ideas that we receive, that we can bring forth. Dare I say, the Los Angelization of the work that we receive and we can bring forth. I thought that would play better to a San Francisco audience, but but you just never know. But let's try the movies. Imagine with me that you're at the movies. These are the perfect, ideal movies. It's 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. You've taken off work early. You're coming into the show. The last trailer is playing. The perfect movies. There's no kid kicking the back of your seat. There's no gum on the floor. And the lights go down and the movie starts. Now, how did you get here? Because movies are a very special thing. Movies are both a product and a service. They're a story. They're a place where we go to enter into the dreams of other worlds and other lives and live through those other worlds and other lives. But they're also a business, and they make a very specific value proposition. A film's value proposition is so extraordinary that if you give a movie 30 seconds of your time, which is the amount of time of a typical television commercial, if you give it 30 seconds of your time, later that movie will get 2 hours of your time and $15 out of your pocket. That's an extraordinary value proposition. Don't we all wish that our creative work, that our entrepreneurial work, could in such a concise way make a value proposition that unique? Movies are also a process because they're part of culture. They create culture, and they are a work process in order to create the film. There is a work culture that we make together on the set to make the movie happen. So they're a metaphor for more than just the dream of the movie. They're a metaphor for work process. They're a metaphor for our lives. They're a metaphor for our wish fulfillment. They're a metaphor for how do we create an environment in which creativity and innovation and entrepreneurship can thrive. Now, there is no denying that our country is at a time of extraordinary crisis. There is no real recovery that anybody that I know is feeling. There is no real recovery that I see except, according to some economists' prediction, on the far, far distant horizon. And when you think about where we are, we know that we need transformational change. Because the usual modes of change don't work anymore. Because you can never change something inside a system. Because change never starts in the center, it always starts on the margins and then moves inside. So you need something extraordinary. You need transformational change. When you think about the actors on the national or the international stage that are able to create transformational change, they need to have the popular support. They need to have the ability, and they need to have the critical mass. But let's look at the kind of actors that we normally look to create transformational change. They're not politicians. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I'm sorry, is just a movie. We will never see a person on the floor of the Congress arguing so both sides fall in line and actually compromise. Politicians are incredibly good at doing the bidding of their corporate contributors. They are incredibly good at choosing sides. They are incredibly bad at finding common ground and enacting a transformational legislative agenda. Or what about business? Many people tell you business can enact transformational change, but we haven't seen businesses act transformational change. We don't really believe that Bain Capital will transformationally change our world. And then the third actor on the national stage is often social movements. Can social movements enact transformational change? It doesn't feel as though they can today. The Occupy movement introduced some new terms into the political discussion, but the Occupy movement has not enacted transformational change. The Tea Party movement may have drawn us to political stalemate, but they have not enacted a transformational political agenda. So we're left with a bare stage. We're left without the actors, without the leaders that we normally look to in order to create transformational change. And that's where we are today. I will submit to you that the actors who have the potential to create transformational change are the creative people and the entrepreneurs. Creative people and entrepreneurs are an extraordinary, if presently unnamed, tribe. I hope that all of you will leave this talk and leave this auditorium being able to name creative entrepreneurs as an actual group of people that we can talk about and name and define. Because nobody else can save us. So let's just see if it's possible for artists, for creative people and entrepreneurs to make a difference. But so first, let's look at whether or not they have the talent. I'm going to ask you to accept that there is enough talent and innovation and creativity in this country amongst creative people and entrepreneurs to make an extraordinary difference. I do not believe that talent gets out there. We'll talk about the prime reason it doesn't fully get out there to be realized, why we have to live with a lot of adequate, but the talent is there. I know, for example, in the movie business, that only about 5% of the movies made every year get released. In any form. Sorry, aspiring filmmakers. In any form. Not even on Netflix. Not even on pay-per-view. You don't want to be part of that 95%. You want to be part of that 5% because you make your movies for an audience to see. So we know, for example, in the microcosm of the movie business, that there is a massive amount of talent going on. And if even only another 5% of those movies are good and are worth seeing, that would double the amount of creative cinema that we could experience in all of its forms and every possible device and tablet and cell phone and cable and cinema screen. But now let's look and see whether creative people and entrepreneurs have critical mass. According to a recent study by the National Endowment for the Arts, there are 2 million people in this country right now who make their primary income from their creative output. These are architects, designers, painters, writers, filmmakers, producers. According to the same report, there are another 30 million creative people who make part of their income from their creative efforts. These are the people whom arts writer Diane Ragsdale calls the pro-ams, the people whose work is at a professional quality, but they're not making the entirety of their income from their creative work. And then what about entrepreneurs? There are today 27 million entrepreneurs and sole proprietor businesses in the United States. Now, entrepreneurs and creative people are actually cut from the same cloth because the muscle that it takes to make a painting on a blank canvas or to design a piece of software or a new iPhone app out of nothing is the same muscle. You may be creating a different product or service, but the drive to create something out of nothing and then be able to share it is the same drive. Creative people and entrepreneurs are charged with the same motor. They move with the same engine. So there are 2 million people who make all their money from their creative work. There's another 30 million people who make some of their money from their creative work. There's 27 million entrepreneurs in the United States. That's nearly 60 million people. That's just about 20% of our population. That is a massive number. That is true critical mass. Now, my friend Richard Florida, 10 years ago, wrote an outstanding book called The Rise of the Creative Class, where he talked about the bohemian society, about places where people congregate. And he talked about creative people, and he talked about his definition of creative class are people who really work with their minds. And he included people who, such as educators and lawyers and healthcare professionals in the creative class. His work is extraordinary, and I am now talking about a somewhat different group, and a group that is 50% larger than Richard Florida's creative class, because his creative class has 40 million people, and we are talking about 60 million people in the creative entrepreneur class in America today. So let's try a thought experiment and tell ourselves a story about what would it be like if we could make a small difference over a medium stretch of time. What would it be like if we could make a 10% change over the next 10 years? If we could bring 10% of those 2 million creative people to be doing really, really, really well financially. That's only 200,000 people out of that 2 million. Could we move 3 million of the 30 million pro-ams to be full-time professional creative people? And could you take 10% of the sole proprietor entrepreneurs, 2.7 million of those 27 million, and have them do really, really well? What would that look like in this country? What kind of innovation and change would we see? And it's really kind of hard to imagine it, because all of you are creative people. I met a lot of you as you came into the room today. And creative people work within a room. And we work within a room that both allows us to do our creative work, but it also keeps us from fully seeing what is outside that room. We have to work in a box. We work on our laptops. We work in our coffee houses. We work in our studios. Artists are really good about their rooms, about their studios. Artists, if you know any artists, you know sometimes they'll say, you can't come into my studio, or if you can come in, you can't touch anything. Visual artists are incredibly good about their protecting their creative workspace. And innovators and entrepreneurs are exactly the same thing. We work in small groups sometime, or entirely by ourselves. We have to work in that isolation so we can be protected, so we can focus, because in order to bring out innovation and creativity, we have to go deep down and we have to get really vulnerable. We have to be in a safe place where that vulnerability can open itself. And of course, the secret is the thing that we feel most afraid to share is the thing that the world wants us to share, because it's a thing that the world needs. But we have to get deep and quiet inside ourselves, inside our rooms, in order to be able to find it and make it safe to bring it out and share it. But then there comes this moment where you have to leave the room. And this is where it's hard for creative people and entrepreneurs. And this is where it stops. And this is where the third factor that brings about social change, which is support, isn't there yet. There has to be support to get out of your room, because most of the time, creative people and entrepreneurs, you're in a room, and you have to open the door to get out of the room. And you have to put your hand on the handle. And a lot of the times, you get your hand on the handle and people stop. And they back away. And sometimes they open the door, and they close it right away. And sometimes they open the door and they look out, and you know, it's not nirvana outside. It's not the Land of Oz where there's a yellow brick road leading you to the perfect Emerald City and a bunch of munchkins to take you there. It looks like the wasteland. It is scary. It looks like the Arctic. But what you have to do as a creative person, as an innovator, as an entrepreneur, you have to open the door and you have to take one step, which is the step of faith, and walk over the threshold and stand outside and feel that icy cold air and realize it's not going to kill you, because really the audience wants you to succeed. Your market wants you to succeed. Your customers, your consumer want you to succeed. How do you know that they want you to succeed? Have you ever downloaded an app and said, gee, I hope this doesn't work? Have you ever gone to a movie and said, gee, I hope this movie is terrible and I leave after 20 minutes? Of course not. Every time you engage with something innovative or entrepreneurial or creative, you want it to be amazing. You don't want it to be adequate. If you have ever been in a theater, when something awful happens, a light falls down, an actor goes up on their lines, and the play has to grind to a stop, the audience is still. And then when it starts again, what does the audience do? The audience applauds, because the audience wants you to succeed. So you have to step out of the door, into your room, and get there. Now, part of the thing that happens when you get out of your room is that you are able to see that it's far more infinite and there's far more potential than you ever imagined there was possible. So let's talk about some penguins. And let's not go to the Arctic, let's go to the Antarctic, because that's where the penguins live. When I was running National Geographic Films, I heard about these crazy French people. These three crazy French people who were wintering over in Antarctica for 13 months shooting film of penguins. Now, that's pretty crazy, but you know, here I was running National Geographic Films, and if you're running National Geographic Films and there's a movie about penguins, first, you're so wired into the natural history universe that you kind of know about it, and second, you know you've kind of got to have that movie. So you try to find out everything you possibly can about that movie. And you send an editor to Paris, to the lab, to take a look at some of the footage coming out of Antarctica as it's being shipped up in batches from the freezing cold and thawing out and getting developed. And the editor calls you and says, this footage is pretty great. So you say, you got to have this movie, right? Now, you may not know that you can actually buy movies. You don't always make a movie. Sometimes when you're a distributor, you can actually buy a movie that is being made and have the rights to distribute it. So you call up the people who are making this movie, and you say, we're National Geographic, we would like to buy your movie. And they say, je suis désolé, but we just got into Sundance today, we're not going to sell it to you. So you say, okay, we're going to go to Sundance, and we're going to buy this movie. And you're ready, because you've seen at least enough of the footage to know that the movie is terrific, or at least the movie could be terrific. And you trust enough in the potential of things that even if it's not terrific when you first see it, you can get it to the place where it is not adequate, where it is terrific. So here you are, and you're in the Eccles Theater, which if you've ever been to Sundance, is the big 1,200-seat major auditorium, and it's the second day of the festival, and it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and this film called La Marche de l'Empereur is about to start screening, and the lights go down, and the filmmakers are there, and the curtains open, and you hear Euro techno-pop music over the opening credits, and it's kind of disco-y, and okay, fine, you can kind of go with that. It's an interesting choice against the blowing winds of Antarctica, but it's a choice. And then, all of a sudden, the penguins begin speaking French. Actually, they're not speaking. They're telepathically talking, and you're hearing their thoughts in French. And there's a daddy penguin voice and a mommy penguin voice. And about halfway through the movie, there's a little baby penguin voice. And you're hearing telepathic French penguin thoughts. Now, you didn't know that penguins spoke French. And you didn't know that they were telepathic. And you didn't know that you could hear them. But there you go. Now, you walk out into the lobby after the screening. And because you don't have a fully built-out distribution system yet, you've got to partner with legit studio distribution companies. And you've already kind of talked to them and said, show up at this screening. We're going to go take this movie, and we want to partner with you. And you're looking at all your potential partners, and they're looking at you like you're nuts. Because here are these French-speaking penguin movies, disco dancing to Euro pop music. And you say, you know, that's what it is now, but it can change. There's a lot of potential. Everything is plastic. Everything can change. And you find one distributor, my soulmate, Mark Gill, who was running Warner Independent Pictures at the time. And he agrees that it can change. And in the next 90 days, change everything about what you hear on that movie. You commission a terrific composer named Alex Werman to write a beautiful symphonic score. And you hire a terrific writer named Jordan Roberts to write a beautiful set of narration lines. And you hire someone who has now become the narration voice, Morgan Freeman, to speak the words. And in 90 days, you completely reversion the movie. And you've created something that was not there before, because you had the ability to get out of the room of that particular project. Now, the filmmakers who made that film, who did a terrific job, and who ultimately embraced for English-speaking audiences the version that we created, had created the perfect version for themselves, the perfect version for what was in their room, the ideal version for their audience and what they could perceive. But they could not at all perceive the idea of another kind of a version, the version that we ended up with. So let's go back to that thought experiment about how do we create this transformation in our society where 10% of the creative people and entrepreneurs are doing very differently and much better 10 years from now. So as this thought experiment, let's just take the 30 million pro-ams, the people who derive some of their income from their creative work, but not all of their income. And how could we move 3 million of those 30 million to derive all of their income from their creative work in a space of a decade? Could we do that? Well, let's see how we might do that. We could do it through exponential growth. Could we start with 3,000 in the next year? Could we find 3,000 of those 30 million pro-ams whom we could move to entirely derive their income from their creative, innovative work in the next 1 year? I think we could, but how would we do that? We'd have to get support. We would have to get teachers. We'd have to get trainers. We'd have to get mentors. We'd have to have programs that would actually show them the pathway of how you open this door and take the step and walk out of your room. And not only walk out of your room, but walk down the path that's going to get you from here to there, and do it without finding dead ends, without running into cul-de-sacs, finding all the shortcuts that people who have done it before can teach you and share with you, so you can actually have a straight line instead of this curvy line that unfortunately so many people make, because we always feel as though we're reinventing the wheel, because we're isolated, because we work in our studios, because we work entirely alone. But what if we weren't working alone? Now, I know from my relationships in the creative industry, very few people were born into these businesses. Very few people were born into creative pursuits. We all came into it because we desired it, and we found people who helped us along the way, but we did it one by one. Can we marshal a group of people? Can we find people who would volunteer or be paid to be teachers and trainers and mentors? I know that we could. I know out of my own Rolodex right now, probably by tomorrow we could sign up 100 of them. And 100 would probably be enough to train 3,000. And if you looked into your Rolodexes right now, you could probably sign up people too, and there are probably people in this room right now or within the sound of my voice who are ideal trainers and coaches and mentors to other creative and innovative people to share what you have learned and pass it on and train the next group. So could we find those trainers and mentors, and could we then connect them with 3,000 people this year to move those 3,000 into that level of financial stability through their creative work? Maybe you start with 6,000 and it knocks down to 3,000 at the end of the first year. But let's say you've accomplished 3,000 at the end of the first year. Could you double that the next year? Well, I think so, because we see examples of exponential growth. And some of the people in the first year, that class of 3,000, would become models and pathways to people in the second year. And then could you double that again in the third year? And if you double that each year, you will get to 3 million at the end of 10 years. We have seen examples of exponential growth in our lifetime and sometimes in very short time spans. 20 years ago, there was $1 billion in organic food sold in the United States. 10 years ago, there was $5 billion of organic food sold in the United States. Last year, $26 billion of organic food. That's a hockey stick pointing upwards. The Tea Party, which you may agree with or disagree with, or agree with some or none or part, the Tea Party did not exist before 2009. They have changed the political environment in an exponential way. Or we can look at examples of exponential change and growth just in the movie business. Let's go back to those Penguins. And it's opening day of the Penguins movie. And March of the Penguins, which ultimately became a popular phenomenon and was seen or talked about by lots and lots of people, opened in two theaters. One in Los Angeles and one in New York. And the first weekend, there were a lot of grandparents. Because people over the age of 50 are primarily the people who go to see specialty movies. But it was full. And 2 weeks later, they brought their grandkids because they discovered that it was a movie that they could take their grandkids to. And 4 weeks later, those kids brought their parents because they said, hey, Mom and Dad, you got to come see this movie with us. And then 6 weeks later, it became a date movie. And everybody saw it, and it became what we call in the movie business a four-quadrant movie, which is a movie that appeals to men and women over and under the ages of 25, and it became a movie that everybody was able to see. It became the second highest grossing documentary of all time. But it did it exponentially. It did not start big. It started very small. And in fact, when we began with that movie, we had no idea that it would ever achieve the widespread popularity that it did. Anybody who tells you that they had a crystal ball and could see that coming is not telling you the truth, because that's simply not the case. You can never predict those things. So if we think about this thought experiment and imagine it as a possibility of creating exponential transformational change, we realize that that's exactly the kind of change that we need in this country. Because we need change that is transformational and different. We need change that does not start at the center. We need change that starts at the outside margins amongst those who are at the edges and then can move in. We need change that can be permanent and systemic. We don't need change that will elide after a few months and evaporate after a year. We need change that cannot go away. Creativity cannot be outsourced. Innovation cannot be outsourced. The manufacturing jobs are not coming back. Yes, some of them will, but most of them won't. So what are we going to do in this country? We have to be creative and innovative. We have to use the tools at our disposal. It used to be called Yankee ingenuity. Today we call it creativity and innovation. And we have to start by naming creative entrepreneurs as a group, as a tribe. We have to go out and say, this is a group that we are part of and that we can name. And to use the tools at our disposal, from guitar chords to poets, words to stories that we tell, to JavaScript, America needs to get creative. And we have about 15 minutes for questions before I have a few closing remarks. So may I invite you to ask questions to the mic, as Kevin has asked, so
right,
we can hear each other.
At this time, I would like to thank Adam, and I would like to remind our audience listening at home, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is featuring Adam Leipzig. Our program is Hollywood Creativity and Entrepreneurship. And now I'm going to turn it over to the audience for some questions, and then we'll, at the very end, we'll have Adam come back and make some closing comments.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your talk, and I am sort of wrestling with this question because I hear what you're saying about creative people needing to step outside the door, but that is not my problem. I spend a lot of time outside the door, and I feel like some of the reason why I am struggling is because there's a dirge of people who want to say yes to me. There's a lot of bureaucracy and walls and online forms that are black holes, and I'm sure we all know all about that. So I guess what I need more clarity on from you is, what is step one for me to help usher in this transformational change that sounds very compelling?
And what are you trying to do?
I am trying to take a dream of... Sounds so silly when I say it out loud.
It's okay to say it. And you know, the thing is that the thing that we really want to do, the thing that motivates us the most, it's often really hard to say because it sounds really corny when we say it.
Okay.
And part of stepping out there is being able to say it proudly, because I guarantee you, whatever you're about to say, everyone in this audience is going to root for you to succeed at.
Okay, I'll say it. I would like to be the Rachel Ray of home canning. I'm an avid home canner, and I'd like to take my ideas and recipes and the fun things I do in the kitchen to a larger audience.
Terrific.
Thank you. Well,
I think you've got about 100 people who want to learn home canning from you right now.
Okay.
the first thing that you need to do is really understand who your audience is. And this is a mistake or a kind of misdirection that many creative people and entrepreneurs have, because we kind of arrogantly think that we know who our audience is. We know who our market is. I do the same thing, so I paint myself with the same brush here. We arrogantly believe that we know the audience because we think, hey, I like it. Everybody's just like me. They must like it too. But that's not really true. We have to really understand who your audience is. Now, if you can figure out exactly who your audience is and really understand the niche of your audience, because we live in a world of niches and micro niches, then you'll be able to not only connect with them and build a platform with them, a way, when I say platform, I mean a way to communicate with them, a way to connect with them, a way to hear what they have to say, a way to beta test what you're doing, get some feedback, help them, have them help you shape it while the clay is still moist and you can still reshape the sculpture so it really serves their needs. Find financing, because all a financier really wants to know is, can you take it to market? Is there an audience for this? Is there a market for it? But you have to identify who the audience or the market is. And we do live in the age of niches. We live in the age where it's either go big, go niche, or go home. And none of us can go big because we don't have $100 and $200 million marketing budgets to go big. And we don't want to go home. So we got to go niche. And when I say niche, I mean super, super micro niche. I mean, get it really, really ratcheted down. You know, Spotify, the online streaming music service, went from zero to about 13 million users in about 18 months because they played the niches. They didn't say, we have music for everybody. They said, we have 944 genres of music. And if you go deep and find the place on their website, you can actually go count that they have 944 genres of music. So they were actually able to target 944 different kinds of fans and have them become rabid, evangelical, visionary fans to spread the word, to build up a foundation. You, of course, don't need 944 niches. You need one really strong niche to begin with. And you could probably connect with them now. And you could start small and then grow out. Because the other thing that we all have to understand is that it's really okay to start small. It's really okay to start with a core group of highly enthusiastic fans. I'm sure you all know the Grateful Dead, if not the most successful rock band in history, among the most successful rock bands in history, having sold hundreds of millions of dollars of albums and paraphernalia and concert tickets. And I'm sure you've heard of Deadheads, who are the people who have gone to every concert, can sing every song, have every T-shirt, have been to every concert, bought every album. Well, there are only about 100 absolutely rabid evangelical Deadheads who have done all those things. That's a shocking number. When I heard that number, I was floored. I thought it must have been thousands. But it's really only about 100. But that 100 is like the core of a nuclear reactor. And their energy is so strong, and it radiates out, and they become the emissaries and the evangelists for everything else that went on with the Grateful Dead. So what do you and I need? Could you find 10 to 20? If you could find 10 to 20 people who are as evangelical about canning as you are but don't know what you know and need your training and guidance, and they would then tell their friends, it would be extraordinary. Because, look, the reason you all turned on your phones before I started talking, and I hope have been sharing a few of the things that you've been thinking as we've been talking together, is that the only thing that matters is what you tell your friends. If you talk to book publishers about what kind of reviews matter, what reviews sell books, they will tell you that reviews in the New York Times do not sell books, and reviews in the New York Review of Books don't sell books, and the only reviews that sell books are reviews on Amazon.com. Next question.
Well, maybe if you could give people some actual pointers, just of, like you did for her, but in a general way, how to start, how to get focused, how to be your own creative development team, and based on your experience.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Well, the first thing is, know who your audience is. And when you know who your audience is, you need to really explore your audience and understand how they want to receive what it is you want to give them. Not how you want to give it to them, but how they want to receive it. You have to turn yourself inside out. You have to learn how to be outward facing, because really you're creating a service. And if you're creating a service, you do not have to do the thing that creative people and entrepreneurs hate doing the most, selling. You don't have to sell. You just have to offer. So you may think that they want to buy your thing in a retail store, but maybe they really want to buy it online. Or maybe they want it to come to their door. Or maybe they want to receive it in some other way. You really have to figure out how they want to receive it. For example, I know that we have some filmmakers in the audience. You have to really ask yourself in today's world, does your audience, whoever your audience is, really want to see your movie in a cinema? Maybe they want to see it at home on one of their screens. Maybe you can even figure out what screen they really want to watch it on, depending on who your audience is. And there is an age demographic thing that may determine what kind of screen they want to watch it on. And if you knew that, you would be able to start to deliver for them in the way that they want to deliver it. The second thing that you need to figure out is why you're doing it. Because if you know why you're doing it, you may discover that there are many different things that you suddenly have permission to do. Let's say you believe that you're a documentarian and you want to shed light on things that people are doing, interesting stories that are told, I want to do, I'm going to walk here. I'm going to play microphone with the audience, if I may. Do you have an idea of what your first document wants to be about? Just say anything right now.
Yes.
Go.
The dream documentary I'd like to do is about vanilla, which is grown by orchids. And out of all the thousands of species of orchids, it's the only one that we gather fruit from. And there's only one type of bee that can pollinate vanilla. And it's the reason why it's the second most expensive spice in the world is because it's hand-pollinated.
All right, so let's say you want to tell the world about the story of vanilla. This is something I never would have guessed. You want to tell the story of vanilla. You've got to figure out who your audience is and how do they want to receive it. But if suddenly you say, the thing that is motivating me in my life is to tell the story of vanilla, well, maybe they want to see a movie about it. And I'm not saying they don't. But maybe they also want to read a book about it. Maybe you want to create thegreatvanillawebsite.com. Maybe they want to have an app that will help them find the best vanilla. There's lots of different things that you can do. There are a lot of what's for every why. As soon as you define yourself broadly enough and say, you're not in the documentary business, you're in the vanilla information business, you suddenly get permission to do a lot of different things, all of which may serve your audience in a different way. When you are able to identify your audience and how they want to receive things, and you know that there are a lot of different what's that you can provide to them, then the thing that you often people think that they need the most becomes the easiest. Most people say, if I just had the money, I could go get that movie made, business started, thing constructed, prototype manufactured. The money is actually the least important thing that you need. You may need money. You probably need a whole lot less money than you think you need. And you certainly don't need money first. Generally, when people do not get money, it's because they haven't shown there's enough value in the thing that they are trying to provide. And if you can show that the value is there, inevitably, the money is there. But that means you've really got to do your homework, understand your niche, understand your audience, know that there is a proven, evidence-based way to say that your audience actually will buy the thing that you want to do. Because if there is an audience for this thing and there's no proof that they have ever bought anything like it, they're not going to buy it from you. And yeah, you have to buy. You know, there's another, Kevin, there's another thing that is often a little bit scary for creative people, and that is you actually have to create something and offer it for sale in order to make a living from it. Now, you know, now I know you're laughing because this seems so boneheadedly obvious, but when writers come to me and say, I'm so depressed, I can't make a living from my writing, I say, okay, what do you have for sale right now? And they say, oh, nothing, I'm still writing it. I say, well, really, you know, unless you are able to offer someone your writing in exchange for something from their debit card, how will you ever pay the rent from your writing? So you really have to understand you've got to create something that you can exchange a value for something else. Now, the next thing to do is you've got to assess your team. You've got to build your team. And you have to do an honest assessment of what you can do and then look at what you're trying to do and see what else is needed. Let's play a game and say that you are a movie financier and you want to hire a first-time director. I've worked with a lot of first-time directors. I did Joe Johnston's first movie, John Turteltaub's first movie, Shireen Davis's first movie, which was America, which we released a few years ago, Yamsur and Dava's first movie, which was the story of the Weeping Campbell, Julie Taymor's first movie, Titus. So first-time director comes and says, I want to make a movie. What do you need to find out? Well, let me tell you what you don't need to find out. Can this person direct? Because if you didn't know that person could direct, you wouldn't have had the conversation with them at all. What you want to know is this person secure enough in themselves that they are willing to surround themselves with masters who have done it 1,000 times before and be the least experienced person on the team? So, for example, when we made Titus with Julie, it was her first movie, and our director of photography had shot for Antonioni, and our production designer had designed for Fellini, and our costumer had designed for Fellini, and our actors were Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange and Alan Cumming, and they had done it lots of times before, and Shakespeare was not a new thing to them. So we had created a cultural environment in which Julie was really well taken care of. And you need to do the same thing for yourself. You have to be strong enough and believe enough in the vision of what you're doing to surround yourself with people who know more than you do and really rely on their expertise. And I'm a great believer in strengths management, which is do what you are strongest at. Do what you are best at. It is what, by definition, will come easiest to you. Whatever comes easiest to you is something you do really, really well. If it's something you do really well, it's something you can always get hired to do. It's something people will always pay you to do. And if you do it really well, it's something other people do not do really well. Most people can do a few things well. Everybody can do one thing extraordinarily well. So find out what you can do extremely well. Build a team around you that fills in the areas of things that you don't have experience in, that you don't do extremely well, and rely on those people to do what they do extremely well. And then you've put together a core group that can really develop the value proposition to take your idea, your creative work, your innovation, your product out to financing, to distribution, and to market. I have time for one more question. Yes, sir, I'm going to hand you the mic.
Hi, my name is Robin. I'm a student at California State University in East Bay. Mm-hmm. And going into your topic about transformational change, I'm really passionate about education reform. And I think we're at a time right now where we can really use technology. I was inspired by seeing this guy. I think he's a calculus teacher, and he's on YouTube. And I believe he quit his job, and now YouTube actually pays him. And it's a lot of money, and he's great at what he does. And he has students around the world that are clicking in and learning calculus from him. And he does it out of this one-bedroom apartment or something like that. And to me, I was inspired by that, and I see that over the next 10 years, that what you're talking about, we could somehow change education to have some type of platform this way. And so my question is, I'm passionate about that, and I don't know where to begin. I'm like, okay, well, are there other people like me who see this and would like to change education in this type of way, and where do I go from here?
All right, so the answer is yes. There's a lot of people who see it.
Okay.
Education is already moving in that direction. Because there are not enough brick-and-mortar classrooms to educate the 8 billion people on this planet. And it is supremely uneconomical to expect those people to be able to pay the tuitions that brick-and-mortar schools charge when people are hungry for education. So can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If you could, right now, what is the thing that you feel supremely qualified to teach? Supremely qualified, right now. I'll give you a hint, guys. If there's something that you feel supremely qualified to teach, it is probably very close to your purpose for being on this planet.
I would say networking, something along
okay.
the lines.
Networking.
Networking people.
Okay.
Networking,
well, there is...
Building organizations.
Okay, perfect. So, right now, there is nothing that prevents you from going home this evening and turning on your laptop and recording your first video and posting it to YouTube and see if you can find 5 students. I'm making it a little bit easier than it sounds. You probably have to have a lesson plan and maybe some nice visuals and make it sticky and kind of figure out if there's a progression. But you could start right now because that's exactly how that teacher started, the person who so inspired you. Just saw that there was a need, and you could start right now. You know, creative people have to become entrepreneurs for themselves, because no one's going to do it for us. We have to do it ourselves. But the tools are now ubiquitous and democratic and by and large free. And entrepreneurs need to become more creative, because the buying decision is an emotional decision before it's an economic decision. And it is creative people who are able to teach entrepreneurs how to find the emotional level of what they're going to try to offer to consumers and to the marketplace. Say a few last words?
Yeah, I'd like to thank everyone for being here tonight. Our program tonight, for the audience listening at home, is featuring Adam Leipzig on Hollywood creativity and innovation, and also some entrepreneurship. And this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. I'm your host for tonight. I'm going to now turn it back over to Adam Leipzig for some closing remarks, and then I'll come back up to close the program.
For the people who doubt, for the people who say it can't be done, remember that number, 60 million. It's a very big number, and don't let it go away from you. You know, every religion has a story about someone who saw miracles, saw the prophet, saw the divine, saw the sacred, and then later denied it. And depending on the faith tradition that you were brought up in, that story could apply to, show of hands, if you're a Christian, it was Peter, thank you, who denied before the cock crowed. If you're Jewish, it was David. If you are in the Islamic faith, it was the Prophet Muhammad himself, who saw the face of the divine and doubted it and was so thrown that he considered suicide until his uncle, who also had touched the sacred, said, "It is true, be of good cheer." And the reason that every religion tells this story is because when something shatters the room that you're in, it's really hard to stay out of that room. Instinctively, we go back into the room, we snap back in as if a rubber band has pulled us back in. So remember, you're all part of the 60 million. You know, my favorite poem by Rumi, who remains the biggest selling poet of all time, shockingly, from this 12th century Sufi poet. My favorite poem from Rumi goes like this. I stood knocking at the door. I knocked until my knuckles broke. Finally it opened. I was knocking from the inside. Let's go back to the movies. Let's go back to that movie theater. We're in the last reel of the movie, that most important reel. The reel that, if it's good, you tell your friends to go see the movie. And as you're watching this movie, you come to the realization that what you're seeing is an illusion. Not just the illusion that those are actors and at the end of Inception nothing really happens with the top because it's only a movie. And there are people who wrote the words that the actors are speaking. You come to the realization that you're seeing the illusion of a dream, because a movie is mainly blackness on a screen and 24 times per second, 24 frames per second, there is a very short burst of light that creates the illusion of movement. Or if you're watching it on a tablet or on a television screen, it's 30 times per second, but it's still mainly a blank or a black screen. And you are putting together the movie in your mind, bit by bit, piece by piece, the way we edit movies when we put them together, bit by constructed bit. You are making sense of these flashes of light and bursts of sound and putting them into a kind of continuity where there are characters and stories, and you realize that that's an illusion. But we live an illusion all the time, because right now you think you're seeing me, and I think I'm seeing you, and you think you're hearing me, and I think I'm hearing you. But really, what you're seeing and hearing are photons and electrons that are bouncing around the room and reflecting off of things, and they are passing through the very small iris of your eye, and they're dodging ganglion cells until they hit the rods and the cones, until they tweak their shape and force them to fire off electrons. And then those electrons go dancing like ballet dancers from neuron to neuron up into your visual cortex, and you assemble a version of reality. So you think I'm standing here as a person with arms here and legs here instead of legs here and arms there. But it's all an illusion. So let's go back to the beginning. Since it's all an illusion, and since you get to construct your reality, and since there are 60 million of us, let it transform, let it shake them out of their seats. It's an illusion, so go make it work.
Okay, thank you, Adam Leipzig. Our program tonight here at the Commonwealth Club has been Hollywood, Creativity, and Innovation. Adam Leipzig. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. I would like to thank you all for being here in the studio tonight. I'd like to thank our audience listening at home. And with this, I will close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.